How was the meeting? Anything that we can share or top secret?
No, it was just, we bought Sweden's biggest podcast company a year ago, 1.5 years ago, I mean, last summer. And then we are preparing for business review and budget meetings we're having, and then for to put together what's the forecast and actually to get approval for the budget for next year for 23.
Very cool.
Quite interesting. Yeah,
no, that's interesting. Very interesting. Were you guys eyeing that company? Because that was just announced somewhat recently. Like, were you saying let's get into the podcast space, and were you eyeing that company, or did the opportunity present itself?
No, actually, because I'm a big fan of podcasts, and I see the similarity to music. You know, it's in many ways, but also because, you know, it's a very medium, very easy to create, and you can think. But of course, you need, it's all about the narrative or about the personality or, you know, the storytelling. But it's really an interesting way. Also, what I believe is to put in our portfolio for amplifying tools. You know, that if you want to. Excuse me, if you want to tell a story about when you have something up and running, and it's not, I don't think it's a solitaire thing. I think it's, you know, a combination of other things. To say that you're doing an Avicii musical or Avicii biopic or Avicii biopic TV series or whatever. And at the same time, you would do 20 episodes of either, you know, one episode is about one Avicii song. And you do that for 20 episodes, you know, and then tell a story, being intrigued about that. That's one way of doing it. You can do it for if you do it for ABBA, you can do it for the same thing, or you do one episode is about one album, you know, etc. And then you do that, and then you tell the story and you anecdotes and what's happening and what's the same. I mean, I think that's, and if you do it about one song, one episode, you would do it like 20 minutes or 25 minutes pods. And I think that is, you know, going to be more and more convenient for people when they commute and everything. So I think that's, I mean, that's why I think it's in interesting. And that's why I, you know, wanted to invest in this company. And I mean, they're the biggest in Sweden, and they have a fantastic football podcast, a soccer podcast that that I love. And yeah, so that's, yeah.
So is that what Pop House is? Because it feels like if you look at Pop House from the outside, you guys have your hands in so many different things. Is it really just what can we find to give our artists, you know, the most interesting opportunities, and how do we expand their brand? And whether that's podcasting or ABBA Voyage or whatever it is, is that really the mission of Pop House, to just say, how can we do creative things with the artists that we work with? Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, I would say that if we invest in a catalog, you know, we do financial due diligence, but we also do a brand due diligence and a narrative due diligence, because what we really want to understand and, you know, evaluate what is there a story to tell behind these artists or the group or whatever. And because we're really intrigued and about telling a story and expose music. Fantastic music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, noughties to a new demography, you know. And of course, it's easy to use Kate Bush now, but if you ask anyone below 35 years old, you know, and ask them, you know, so did you know of an artist called Kate Bush? And everyone below 35 I talked to, maybe that's a crazy demography I've been talking to, but no one, they honestly, did you know about an artist called Kate Bush before? No.
Or maybe they know the name, but they don't know the music.
Yeah. I mean, what the people I've asked, you know, they didn't even know the name. So they didn't know what to search for, you know. And of course, they're well-educated youngsters below 35, you know, that know about Kate Bush, of course. But, you know, going from nowhere, from zero to hero, if you say with Kate Bush, thanks to one sync in one TV series, that is sort of say locked in, or it's not locked in, but it's in, you have to watch it on Netflix. I mean, that's amazing. You know, I mean, that's really, because that shows that song, not exposed to anyone before, but when it was, it's competed with all the good music it's done today. And I think that's really fantastic. And that's really what we want to do with everything we buy, to expose it for new generations, for new demographies, for new regional places. You know, if where music has not been as easy to access as it is today.
Talking about like ABBA Voyage, which I've read a lot about and seen a lot of videos, but I cannot I cannot imagine what this is like. I feel like I need to go to London just to see this. But how do you describe it to people who, like, how do you describe it to someone who's never seen it? Like, what is it?
First of all, you have to promise me you go there. Otherwise, we stop this interview now.
I'm dying to go. But it has to come to America, right?
Well, let's say like this. This started, you know, as a project 2016. And then it's evolved into various, into various directions. It started more like a hologram thing from, you know, Tupac 2012 and Michael Jackson and Billboard Awards 2014. And then that was, you know, the idea from the beginning to take it on tour, a hologram tour or something. But and then we went over to Las Vegas and saw Michael Jackson number one in, you know, their show. And there's a story about this or slash musical or whatever, you know, how you can say it. And then in the end, there's one song as a hologram. And I was there with Björn Benny Jörel, who's manager for ABBA since 50 years back, and Ludwig's, which is Benny Andersson's son, who became the producer of the show. And they didn't like it, you know, and we didn't like it, you know, because, you know, it was like one song in a hologram, then you need to sit in a specific place. You can't really scale it in the way you want. And it will get boring after three songs, you know. So we just had to rethink everything and what should we do and how should we set this up. And then eventually we went to Industrial Light and Magic a fantastic Ben Morris, who's the creator director or SVP or whatever. He was in charge of the ILM side creating this together with a fantastic art creative producer called Bailey Walsh. And they created this, and then together with the producers Svana Gisla and Ludwig Andersson, you know, just came up with this, every song, everything what should be in it, so make it more like a stage performance in the way that, you know, every song had their own theme. They change clothes, they talk to the audience, it's a live piece, 10-piece live band on the stage, you know. I mean, I was in charge more of signing off the invoices, and, you know, I asked about, you know, we had, you know, weekly meetings and the creativity, but, you know, I thought there were so many people having views on that, and they did it really well. So I was more on that side and raising money and, you know, gearing up enthusiasm. But then I came an invoice on the clothing, and I said, "What is this?" And it was, you know, I won't tell you the sum, but it was really expensive. You know, I said,
for the
this?
Holograms or for the band?
No. Again, this is not holograms. It's we don't have done holograms. This is done in a different way, and you have to see it to understand it, because we're working on screens, huge LED screens. But this was what they said. We are from Dolce & Gabbana. From, you know, it was just. And it was extremely expensive. And I won't tell you how much, because it's going to freak you out. And I said, so how are we going to use this in this clothing? You know, and ABBA had iconic clothes, you know, when they performed and when they was on tour, not so many tours, but when they did, they really have iconic dresses. And then I said, and the cost, you know, what the fuck, you know, what, you know, and I was really, you know, upset, you know, but then they said to me, but Per, you know, we have to show that this is from today. They need to have iconic clothes from today to show that they are here now. And then I said, yeah. But does it have to cost this money? But eventually I signed off on it. But, you know, those clothes have not been worn by anyone. They've been worn, you know, it's just... But they are real clothing, you know. So they have... And then you film them, and then you put them on the avatars... And then then you record it, and then you put it together. It's really amazing, and that is one of the things that's truly, you know, one, you can say, little piece, but very important piece that, you know, I wouldn't have focused on, but, you know, the creative team did, and I think that's done an excellent job with it.
And are they the perfect band, because do they basically say, we haven't toured in so many years, but yeah. we have this massive following. So they're the perfect band to do this with. And then didn't all the members of the band go into a studio or somewhere and basically put on these suits, and we're basically seeing them act yeah. essentially?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this was, as we said, they had to wear motion cap suits and helmets for 4 weeks. We had, you know, we had a studio here in Stockholm, and I mean, the four ABBA, four of them, Frida, Agneta, Björn and Benny, they really loved it. You know, they went together for the first time in, you know, I mean, they, of course they met before, but you know, they, when they split up, both, you know, from they divorced in, you know, in both as a band, but also as right. a couple. And since they then they haven't toured, you know, they and then they went together and did this, and you know, it was like 100, you know, CGI engineers from ILM sitting there. It was like crazy, you know, and it looks like NASA, you know, when they or SpaceX now when they're shooting up a rocket, you know, it's like it was unbelievable. And I'm the most, you know, amazing thing is this didn't leak. This didn't leak anywhere. No one knew that happened, you know. And then we had body doubles because when you are 70 plus, you don't dance. And
I was going to ask. So no, what was being captured?
No, we had body doubles that could, you know, that played Frida, Agneta, and Björn and Benny. And we had a fantastic choreographer, Wayne McGregor, you know, that did all the choreography first with Björn, Benny, Frida, Agneta, and then with the body doubles. And worked very closely together and did this amazing, you know, I mean, again, you have to see it because I shouldn't describe it, you know, too much because, you know, and I won't tell the stories about it and what's happening inside the show because you have to be there and just embrace it and you're going to love it. I know it because that's what happens now. We run now 164 sold out performances, consecutive sold out, 99% occupancy. We've sold over 800,000 tickets now, you know. And it's
you need to sell 6 million tickets to break even. Is that what the number is?
No, 3 million. Oh, 3 million.
3 million, excuse me. 3 yeah, million tickets.
Yeah.
Oh, so you're like, it's a no-brainer at this point. It's all...
No, yeah, you know, I mean, we're selling out. I mean, we're going to be sold out. I guarantee we'll be sold out until, you know, January 10th or something. But it's, we're selling tickets, you know, we opening new buckets and it's I mean, what can I say? It looks if I would knew that this was where we're going to be in November 2022, you know, I would just start drinking champagne. I would have been in love and shame with everything. I don't know, but I think that is, but you know, I this is a long journey, and 4 weeks before the show had premiere, I was asked to come into the, you know, to the arena. It was just the crew and the producers, and they said sit here, you know. And then they played me four songs, and after on the screens and how it's worked, not full capacity, but it just showed me how it's going to be. And I started to cry at the second song was "Lay Your Love on Me," and because I was so relieved, because I didn't know that it would work, really. I mean, it would be a nice thing to watch, but, you know, would it be immersive? Would it be as it is today? And, you know, I started to cry because of relief. Everyone that we have engaged, and everyone that really have supported us with money and energy and capacity and everything. So it was fantastic.
And will anything else ever go in this arena, or the goal is this runs for 10, 20 plus years and this just
it's an arena that we can move, you know, it's dismantleable, we can move it to another city. We would prefer, I mean, London and UK has been the town, so we also now in talks with both, and we have six on Friday is the six casinos slash hotel that comes from Las Vegas. So it's, everyone is really, I mean, maybe they won't come up with a proposition to us, but every one of them, maybe they are there to see this, what it is, because it's the talk of the town in the entertainment business. But we know for sure that they want to do it in Vegas. And I think that's one place going to come up. And we also 2 weeks ago, we were in Singapore, and we also had a meeting this week with it was Paul Dainty from Live Nation in Australia. We're not going to be everywhere in the world because it's a big you know task to set this up. But again, you know, when you've done it once, you know, it's easier. But it's a big thing, and so we're going to be in London for as long as possible, you know, and hopefully we can stay. But we plan to be there until for a while, 3 years, 3.5 years, and then after that we either take it to Berlin or we take it to somewhere else in the world and dismantle it and build it up somewhere else.
But I need to come and see it in London before it goes anywhere else.
I mean, the audience are amazing. As I said to everyone that goes, you know, wait until, you know, it's 5 minutes left when the announcement comes, you know, now you have to come into arena, then you should go in because the ambience, the anticipation from the audience, this, you feel it's like it's something's big is going to happen. You know, it's, this is, you know, it's going to be, and everyone just so enthusiastic in there, and you feel you can touch it. It's mesmerizing before it starts. And then when it starts, yeah, you have to go and see it. You know, that's what I have to
tell. Oh my
yeah.
God, I have to go and see this. You've like got me so jazzed about this. I'm now I want to hop on a flight next week and check
it
out.
You should. Visit your brother. You know, it's Christmas coming.
It's Christmas coming. I need to go. Okay, so you've been a leader in the music industry for close to over 20 years, but you started originally in television, or originally you were.
Oh yeah, but if I go back, I started 89. I started at I'm actually the MBA from business science in the university in Sweden. And then I was into selling computers, and then I went into I moved to Stockholm and started CBS Records 89. That was then changed to Sony Music in for 1st of January 1990. I worked there for 3.5 years, and it was a boom of the CD, the start of the boom of the CD. And then I went to start commercial radio in Sweden, and then after 2 years, I was recruited to be head of entertainment for Sweden's biggest TV station. And then 98, I was recruited by Paul Russell to become the CEO of Sony Music. They wanted me back, and I was there for over the merger between BMG. And then 2008, I was approached by Universal. You know, Max Hall and Lucian and recruited me to Universal. It was like going from you're talking football language, you're going from Manchester United to Manchester City. You shouldn't do this. But I thought that, you know, that, I mean, the leadership at that time, I felt was not, I mean, it wasn't good at Sony Music. And I felt that Lucian and Max and, you know, they're thinking, you know, they were, yeah. And I wanted a new environment, you know, and
yeah.
They gave me that. And then, and I also was coincidental with the growth of, or the start of Spotify, which started October 2008. And then the spring of 2009 was just amazing, because then it was the trial and the verdict of Pirate Bay. Spotify had just started, and it was also there's an EU, they have an enforcement directive, you know, which against if you upload it, you were always a crook, but if you download it from April 1st, 2009 in Sweden, you can also get caught. That law has never been used, but it was a very, very important symbolic value. And in combination with that, you know, Spotify was better than legal downloading. You know, that's really the story here, you know, because Spotify was better than all other services, because, you know, you didn't have Trojans or worms or in your computer. It didn't, you know, your computer didn't crack. You were never a problem with it, you know, and so it's just, it was a perfect software and a perfect service. So, and that I was part of, which was fantastic. And I went from Universal. I was the worst performing CEO when it comes to digital revenue per micro GDP in 2009. And 3 years later, I was number one.
Right.
And that was not thanks to me. I was really, I signed a lot of artists, and I really went for it, because I was new at Universal. And I said, I can't be a wimp, if I so call it that. I have to, no, sorry for using that word, but I can't be a coward. I need to be.
That's not a bad word.
I need to go all in on this, you know. So I did. When everyone else in Sweden didn't do anything, I just went all in. And then so also. Wait.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So was... yeah, yeah. Go.
No, go.
So there's a scene, first of all, breaking it down a little bit. There's a scene in this new Netflix series, The Playlist, where you have this like run-in with Lucien in the Sony corporate office. That's not how it happened, right? That's not real. That's not real. Okay. So Lucien, does he approach you and does he just poach you? He recognizes you as a brilliant leader and he says, you know, you should be working for us over Universal. Is that basically how that happens?
Well, what happened was that Max Holz wanted to meet me in London and, you know, he wanted to hire me. And he said, before we can hire you, you have to see Lucien. And at that time, Lucien was working from London. So he was head of international, but living in London. Max was head. I can't accept, but I had to have the approval from Lucien. So I'm sitting with Lucien in his room and he played me the Duffy album, which was, you know, produced by Bernard Butler, which was excellent. Yeah, that's her debut album. And we talked about music and then he said, fine. It was very, very...
It was easy.
No, I mean, yeah, it was easy. He was super soft and, you know, you felt his charisma and, you know, his way of thinking. And, you know, he's a winner. You can say,
yeah.
You don't want to do it.
So, and then because you're really credited with being like the first industry person, I guess, to embrace Spotify or to see the value. Yeah. Like, how do you meet Daniel Ek for the first time?
No, it was he did a lot of presentation and one of them was, you know, at Sony, where I was at the first time I saw it, and then at Universal, and then I also had a meeting with him, you know, just talking about how we should market it in I have photos from that year. Yes, well, a friend Sam, who was was with me there to see, because I said, come follow me to this crazy thing that I think say the music industry called Spotify, and he followed me there, and so he took photos, and I still have photos from that, and we talked about how to market it and what's the next steps and everything for Spotify in Sweden and in the world. And it wasn't that I was smart, you know, and it was more like I was desperate, because, you know, we had to, there must be something that could start, you know, monetizing music again for Swedish, you know, music consumers. You should know that from 2000 to 2008, the music revenue for music industry went from 1.6 billion to below 800 million over 8 years, or 9 years actually. And so half the value in revenue for artists and record companies was lost in 9 years. And that wasn't due to that people in Sweden listened less to music. It was that, like, they downloaded illegally. I said they were stealing, but, you know, that's, you know, it's depends who you are, what you say. But that's what happened in those years. So that was really, for me, a thing that I started to be an advocate for it. And, you know, I'm quite, I say what I think, which is not good all the time. So Spotify, you know, they called me up. Can you do an interview with the Wall Street Journal? Can you do an interview with the Johannesburg, you know, Post or whatever it was called? And I think I did, you know, 10, 15 interviews about what is Spotify with newspapers that in across the world, you know. And I went through through Universal, you know, offices in everywhere, you know, Germany, Holland, Italy, US, all the labels there. To this is how we do it. This is how it works. This is what you should do. And, you know, and then with that came a lot of things that, you know, and it was fantastic. And the thing was that I also became the president for Universal Nordic. And I said to all the Nordic countries and all the A&Rs, we have a window of opportunity for the next 3 years. This was 2012. So, because then if you were top 10 or top 5 in Sweden on the Swedish Spotify chart, you were automatically were top 50 on the global chart, because there were so many Swedes compared to everyone else in the world that was using Spotify. So by default, so you were up there. So that's why I signed, you know, I signed all the EDMR. I signed Avicii 2010. When Swedish House Mafia broke up, I signed Axel Ingrosso. Dada Life, Alesso, Tuvalu, you know, many more, you know, Anaus, Recafiona, that really had an international traction. And it was really because it was easy, you know, and, you know, right now it's a lot of Latin artists, you know, that are breaking through in,
right.
You know, because there's so many Latin listening to Latin music there are on Spotify. So that's one of the biggest, you know, genres right now. When it's quite interesting.
You said on the Music Business Worldwide podcast, and there's also a scene in the Netflix series where you've come across someone who's stealing music on Pirate Bay, and your character in the series gets into a big fight. But it sounded on the Music Business Worldwide podcast like maybe there was some accuracy to that.
No, 100%. I mean,
yeah.
Some people ask me, you know, when they see it, were you that angry? And I said, I was angrier, you know.
Because, you were angrier. You know,
yes. And then I wasn't that. Not, you know, I never told Daniel Ek that thing on the street when I went in a cab. You know, that never happened either. But a lot of things were true. And of course, I represent maybe 3-4 different, you know, music business people, you know. So, I mean, you have to tell a story in one way. But for me, it was like in the scene that I go into a lawyer, you learn to know new people through your kids, your children, you know, and then you're invited to, to a drink or, you know, some food or, you know, whatever. And what happened during those years, you know, when you went over there, what you see in the scene in the Netflix playlist TV series, I'm sober. I'm coming there, you know, with no alcohol in my, you know, and you can think when you're drinking a little bit, you know, and you see, and then suddenly someone, you know, put on, you know, music and it's Pirate Bay playing. You can imagine I was furious. What the fuck are you doing? You know,
right.
Are you teaching your children to steal, you know, from the closest 7-Eleven? No, oh, fuck you. No, I was more like, I was more into a fight, you know. So my wife told me, you know, next time we go, you can't tell anyone what you work with. It's better that you get drunk than you tell that you work in the music industry. But everyone said, oh, that can't be easy to work in the music industry. Why not? Because we don't buy albums anymore. What do you do? My son, I tell my son what I want and he has downloaded for me. Thief, you know, liar.
Right.
Yeah. So I was ready to... So I was, but it was super tough times, you know, when BMG and Sony merged, you know, I mean, 50% of the workforce has to be fired. And in 2 days in Sweden, I fired 40 people. I was personally sitting and fired 40 people. That was terrible.
And in that moment, I mean, it seems like in that moment, was it so dramatic with Pirate Bay and were those characters who were running it, were they so public about it at the time?
Yes, they were heroes. You know, in Sweden, there was even a pirate party that went into the parliament, you know. It was crazy.
And isn't it crazy that at that time, like, you probably came up idolizing people in the music industry who worked in the music industry, and then it became, like, the uncool thing, and you became, like, the bad guy for just trying to create music. Is that kind of what the environment was or what it felt like?
Both yes and it was more like, you know, you have to understand the future. Internet is free. You can't control it anymore. This is, you're dinosaurs. We don't, no one wants a record company. So that's why, you know, the story went from defending the record industry or record companies or executives in the music industry to defend the artists. Because, you know, say, okay, fuck the record companies and the music industry. But what about the artist? Are you? How should they survive? And they say, you can buy merchandise. You can sell merchandise. It's just, you know, which is just, crazy. It's like people don't understand it. But nevertheless, that was the language at that time. You know, it's all about defending. And because this was not only music, Pirate Bay was the fifth, one or 2 days was the second biggest place after Google on the internet, you know, during 2007, 8, 9 there, you know. And number five in the Sweden, you know, number five in the world, you know. So it was not only music, it was also movies, you know. I mean, I was witness for the music industry in the trial, and also a Swedish lawyer was witness for the MPA, Music Motion Picture America, you know. So everything, this was a big thing. I mean, young people don't really recall what's happening.
Right. So when Spotify came in, did you basically feel like it was your job to go around and basically tell everyone that they have a model here and that this is better? because they always talk about how the music industry missed Napster the first time, and that if they had embraced Napster, you know, it wouldn't have been as detrimental as it was if they'd figure out how to monetize it. And now you sort of realize that this was another opportunity that if we don't partner with a company like Spotify, it's going to get out of our hands, or it's going to, like, you realize that this was a key moment to take advantage of, basically. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say this Spotify was not the only platform that was developed during these years. But I would say that without Pirate Bay, Spotify would never get the license that they get, you know, because they almost killed the music industry, you know, I mean, Pirate Bay. And then by threatening it so much and see how much we lost, you know, see how much an industry failed, you know, and Sweden was the worst because we were the most internet connected kind, because you talk about broadband connectivity, you know, and then you see, okay, what's broadband? It's the definition is 256 kilobit per second, and no one would even pay for that today. But that was the definition during the noughties, you know. So, but Sweden had super good, you know, wires, and, you know, in and so that's why a lot of people downloaded and started to learn to use the computer as their entertainment altar, if I call it that. And so when the good service came, Spotify, then no one bought a stereo, you know, and they were really used to use computers and listening to consume music through that. That's why Sweden was like in the forefront, you know, and that's why, you know, it went so fast because it just switched it to another software, which was much better, as I said, you know, and that's why. And then of course, I saw that, you know, and by what Sweden, the what Universal saw that and saw that what happened in Sweden, if that's the truth, you know, we have to look into this, you know, and then they started to look into it. And you know, Avicii was, you know, one, you know, I signed him 2010 before he was Avicii.
When he was Tim.
Yeah, when it was Tim Berg, which was the song, as my first signing was a song called Bromance, then became Seek Bromance. And so for me, that was, you know, that I saw how easy it was to sell music in other countries, you know. So the better or bigger I can make Spotify in the world, the more my signings can make it. Because if you were in this fiscal world, you know, I have to convince, let's say, David Joseph in UK and his, you know, labels that say, please, you have to manufacture my album physically, take a risk on it, put it out in all the stores in UK, and then start marketing it.
You had no distribution costs.
Yeah, basically. Because you can imagine, they have to take a risk. They have to take a strategic bet on it, but they don't have to do nothing, because if you launch it on Spotify, it's everywhere.
Right.
So that's what, so if the bigger I can, the more I can help Spotify to grow, the better I can perform.
Okay. So and how do you sign Avicii? How do you find him, and how do you realize that he had such a gift for melody and music?
I didn't know that he was that gifted, you know, but I was at Ibiza I was invited to the premiere gig for the residence that Swedish House Mafia had at Pasha that summer, 2010. They also just signed a deal with Virgin, and they had the one coming up, and, you know, and then it's, they just, and I said, you know, went to the Pasha, and they, when are they on? 2:30. And I said, what, and you're kidding me, you know, 2:30, they on, you know. I said, okay, fucking hell. I was just, okay. And Kylie Minogue is a supporter. Kylie Minogue supporter to the three, you know, overweight, not overweight, but, you know, there wasn't, you know, Brad Pitt standing there, you know. So it was just, and then I went down to the dance floor. The music came on. It just felt in my body. I get goosebumps talking about it now. And I went down to the dance floor, and it was 70% men fist pumping up to the DJ booth. And I was just, this is rock and roll. This is, yeah. I ask a shiver now when I talk about it, because it was so transforming for me. And I went out 5:30 in the morning. It was, sun was going up, and I said, I have to sign. I have to go into this. And I knew that they were signed. So I talked to my friend who was creative director at Universal Music Publishing, Jonas, and he said, you know, you have to help me. Where do you? Because he was a publisher for Swedish Mafia. I need to find someone. You know, I need to find. I need to. In, this is going to be the future. And he sent me three links to different artists, and one was called Tim Berg, you know, and I liked it. And then I called up, set up a meeting with his manager, Arash Purnuri, Ash, and Tim, and they came into my office, and I signed Tim Berg for Sweden, Norway, Finland. That's one of the territories I can buy them. And then I did a really good job, because then I get a song called Penguin as a with non-vocal version, and then Fade in the Darkness as the vocal version. And I signed that for the all of Nordic, and then came Levels. And Levels, you know, was
game changer.
Game over. Yeah.
And when he turns in Wake Me Up and he does the performance at Ultra, did you immediately sense that it was brilliant, or did you go, what's with these banjos and acoustic guitars?
No. I heard the album before, and you know, I invited, you know, was it 25 people from all over the world we had a drink table, you know, I wanted to cater them because this is going to be the big thing. And, you know, we had a conference the day before. And so, and then we were ready to go, and he comes up and he do a 45 minute show. And then it was like a changeover, because he didn't say anything. And suddenly there was a man in a basker, you call it that, you know, the, you know,
yeah,
on his head, and he was, I mean, which was Ailo Black then, and did Wake Me Up, and with acoustics and guitars and everything on the stage, and people didn't know what it was. And then came Alison Krauss, you know, Dan Timinski and his team up, you know, and did, you know, Hey Brother, and the people start booing, you know.
That this was the thing, is like blogs were like, even at the performance at Ultra they did in 2013, like everybody, it wasn't obvious. Like now looking back, it was so big, but people didn't like it, right?
No, they didn't. No, they hated it. No,
they hated it.
Yeah, people at the site, meaning watching this set, they hated it. And it was, you know, it was terrible on the social media afterwards. I mean, RIP. Avicii's career, you know, everything was just, he lost it. And then, Ash, his manager, came up to me and said, you know, I mean, and I remember also Andrew Kronfeld, who is the CMO for Universal, he said to me, you know, we know how good the album is, this will go over, you know. Of course, I'd paid $5 million for the album in advance, you know, so I was nervous. I was convinced before, but you know, I get some, of course, some. So what is, because we were so sure about the songs and the album, but you know, and then Andrews and Kronfeld said, remember Dylan and when he was called Judas, when he plugged in his guitar, you know, this is just, people don't understand it. They will not realize. And Arash, you know, then called me and said, you know, we want to make a remix of the songs and put it out on SoundCloud. Oh, you can't do it because we have this, you know, we have the rights for it. You can't do it.
Right.
And then he played it to me and said, you know what? You should do it, but don't tell me. I'm gonna send you a note saying you're infringement of everything what you do. But we need to do it as a marketing tool, you know. And so that was just a play we did. And as soon as you get out on that mix on SoundCloud, because SoundCloud was also super big at this time, you know, and all the, you know, it just exploded. And from there, it was just, again, a game over, because it was just, everyone has realized, this is unbelievable. This is just a mixture of country and, you know, and rock, not really, and EDM, dance music and everything. It's just, yeah.
Did you think, though, it was brilliant when you heard it, even if it made you nervous, or were you unsure the first time you heard it?
No, when I heard Wake Me Up first time, I was just, wow. And I was sitting in the studio, and I said, and I had to say it, because I had one guy from Universal with me, and I just, we can't be too enthusiastic, because I know how Ash going to react, because I haven't done the deal with the album then. So this could work. It's different, but it could work. There was like what you said.
You were playing it cool. You were like,
because we have bicycles, you know, very close to the studio. So I said, this is crazy. Well, I mean, you don't tell anyone what you thought about this, because we thought it was fantastic, you know. And I said, this is taking it from the dance floor to pop music, you know. And so this is the next level. But, you know, I have to admit, after, you know, Ultra, you know, on that night, you know, I had to have some drinks. I can tell you that.
So because you were worried, oh my God, maybe this isn't going to work, But were you confident? It really wasn't obvious. Like, now it seems so obvious, but you really thought this was going to flop, and you had spent $5 million
on the album. I was shocked that night over the reactions from the audience and from social media. I was. We listened to the album again on the day after, and we said this have to work, you know. And then we just talked about, you know, the obvious single, which was "Wake Me Up," and But you know, when you're in it like that, and you can say, you know, of course, you have to be confident to the people, the team around you. But you know, it was a seed of questioning. Yeah, it was. But then when you saw the reactions on SoundCloud, you felt this is it. We were right all the time. We were right all the time. That sounded like. But you know, the crazy thing is, when you are in this kind of thing, in this, you know, this fantastic, you know, summer with "Wake Me Up," you don't really enjoy. You just think about what's going to happen next. Well, you know, it's not. Is it still number one? Yeah, but what is it next week? You didn't celebrate in the way that you should do. I think that you have to be. Maybe that's part of, you know, why the drive you have in you, because you're never satisfied. But it's also that I regret that I celebrated more, you know. I mean, that's because it's, you always think about what's the next single, you know, when we're shipping the album, how's the album, or, you know, all these kind of things you think about all the time. So yeah.
Do you regret not taking a moment to just take in the feeling of what it felt like to have the biggest song in the world, or would you literally have thrown more parties or done more things or both?
I don't know. I can tell. I didn't even need more parties. We had it was quite good at that time. It was, you know, we had meetings in Ultra in Miami and Ibiza in the summer, you know, and that was my job. You can imagine, you know. So, but it was more like, you know, take it, you know, embrace it, you know, from mentally more, you know, just look what we've done, you know, look what we've been part of, look what, you know, what we helped Tim to accomplish, you know, that's what, you know, what was really what you should have done more, you know. But it's always that next, and also his manager, Arash Panuri, he's not the guy that is relaxing. He yes, next. That's his way of thinking. Yeah. You know?
Can you do that now with the ABBA Voyage? Because that feels like a massive monumental moment and
I think I do. But then again, you know, we think about where we're taking it next. You know, we're not recouped yet, but you know, all signs points that it's going to be a massive success, and it's already a turnkey, or you know, a revolution when it comes to live entertainment. You know, it is. You know, you can say whatever, but it is, and it's a privilege to be a part of evolving. You know, the live entertainment in the way we've done. That's right. Fantastic. I mean, I'm so privileged to be part of what I've been part of. Yeah,
I mean, Tim clearly trusted you as a friend and an ally, and his family and estate just sold the catalog to Pop House. But looking back though on it, like, did you get the sense that his schedule was crazy when you look back on it? Or do you wish that someone had brought the touring back a little bit sooner?
You can always say that. And yes, he was too much. But again, I would say that it's really important to say that. Because in the documentary, it looks like, you know, he was toured to death or to suicide, you know, but that's not the case. He stopped touring 2016, 17. 16, he stopped, you know, really, his last summer. And then, what happened was that he was just in a good place. He took a time out, went to Madagascar, he relaxed. And then he just did what he loved most, be in the studio. So so Tim was in a really good place. You know, I had a telephone conference with the A&R team in a Monday night, and he just arrived to Oman. And he was okay, let's go. Where we booked studio? I want to be in Africa, you know, Nigeria, but I want to have inspiration from people from down there. Can you set up a studio for me to do in August or, you know, in. That's him, you know. And then he wanted to be in somewhere in London, you know, to be more about, you know. And he was always on, and he was in a really good place. On Monday, 1 week later after the meeting, he sent me a note, you know, saying, do you know this artist? Oh, well, she signed to Virgin UK, you know, and we can, if you want her, you know, this is a fantastic voice. I love it, you know. I mean, I called, you know, Jason and Ted Cockle, you know, to see if we can get her to be participate. Yeah, yeah, I do that. I'm not sure which song yet, but yeah, let's talk about that later, you know. And then 4 days later, I get a phone call sitting in a restaurant waiting for my wife, and that he was dead.
Wow.
If that would have happened 2016, fine, but not 2018. I didn't understand.
Is the pressure to keep his legacy alive now that Pop House has the catalog and to keep the music alive? Or
no, but that's been, I was with him from 2010 too, and I was also part of concluding the album that wasn't finished. And then the parents wanted me to be part of the board of Tim Bergling Foundation. And I always, you know, try to treat him with respect and, you know, try to honor his legacy and try to spread it, as you know, because I think his music is genius. It's that work by a genius, you know. There of course are many geniuses in the world, you know. That how people are thinking about music, to create music. And he worked with so many artists, and everyone that he worked with is Nile Rodgers, you know, Chris Martin, you know. I mean, everyone says, he said, you're a genius, man. You know, that's, you know, it's, he was, you know, and I want to honor, and I want to tell everyone how fantastic he was, you know, and without Papa's buying the masters, as we've done 75%, because the family wanted to keep 25%, which I think is really, really good and interesting way of doing this, because they want to be part of what we're doing. So I would have endorsed it, even though it wasn't mine too. I would have endorsed it just because I love it, you know, and I think it's work done by a genius. And he was, if you see when we did the Tim album, you know, concluded where he was, and the producers that worked with him just finalized their songs. And they all said that if Tim would have been alive, it would have been sound differently, but we're going to try to do it as good as possible. And they also talked there about how it was to work with Tim. And I think that's on YouTube, and it's quite, you know, it's quite sensitive and fine. And I'm proud of being a small, small piece of all that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so cool. Per, we're running out of time here.
Yeah, we do.
But this was such a pleasure. So basically, you need to get to London to see ABBA Voyage. Everyone listening, you have to book a flight, and you need to go. And it's gonna be incredible. Do you spend any time now working with new acts? You said recently in an interview that you think the smartest people in the music industry are going to move into catalog. And working catalog. What do you mean by that? That's really the future?
Yeah, no, I just say that since Spotify and others are releasing 100,000 songs per day, I think it's so crowded. You know, it's so tough to have a breakthrough. You can have a one-hit wonder, and that's not easy. But if you have that, that's one thing. But to create an artist brand, you know, for the future, to go out and do big, you know, tours, you know, that is so tough today. But what I'm saying is that, but then again, and if you, they also, the new artists, new songs compete with the catalog. And the catalog, I mean, as I say, music age better than wine, and wine age better than, you know, TV series and movies. Because if you look at movies and TV series from the 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, even 90s, you know, you can't watch them because they're too slow edited, and you know, it's just, you know, the lightning and the setup and the storytelling. It's bad, you know. I mean, you can just say Batman, and you go back from the 60s and 70s, you're gonna, what the fuck? Why did Disney bought the, you know, Disney bought, sorry, it was DC Comics, sorry, but you know, it was, everything. It's so much better, you know, when it comes to music. It's still, you know, I mean, you can take any artist. You can take Supertramp. You can take, Thin Lizzy. You can take, you know, Barbara Streisand. You know, I mean, the Bee Gees. I mean, when did Barry Gibb? You know, it's everything is so good, you know. There's so much great music done before, and that's not, people don't know about. That is hidden gems, and therefore I think that, and also the music industry, the deals that the labels have with them is so much better. The margin is twice as good as it is when they were signing a new act today. So that's why I think it's going to be by default. That's going to happen. The smartest people are going to go into to embracing and amplifying and showcasing the greatness of the artists from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. You know, you saw the Elvis movie. You see what I mean? That's what an artist, you know?
Right.
And he
never
performed outside US.
Right.
I can help him. No, Papa's can help him.
Where's the Elvis the Elvis show or the Elvis Museum? Pop House yes, exactly. Needs to do it. Is it weird to see yourself portrayed in a Netflix show?
Yeah, but that was crazy. You know, it's like you have questions sometimes. Yeah, well, which actor would play you in a movie about yourself? Or you know, that's kind of, you know, and then someone called me up and said, I'm gonna play you in a TV series and said, what? And then nobody. And then I had a meeting with him, and you know, it was he's from the same town up north of Sweden, so he has the same dialect as me. You don't understand it if you're not Swedish, but people in Sweden say, how did they make him talk like you? that was just a coincidence.
Wow. And did you like the series? Did you think it was super dramatized, of course, but did you feel that it captured the essence of what was happening at that time? Or was it?
I think you say that the witness, you know, tells the history, you know, and I feel that, you know, I can live with that. If people believe that that was what happened, even if it's not true, I think it's really good for me and, you know, my legacy, what I did. And I'm of course thankful for that. And but again, I was part of it and I feel very proud of that too. And I think the TV series is really interesting done, and how they change, I think the Petra Hansson, the lawyer episode is really good. And I think I'm not sure about the last episode, because I think Daniel Ek is not that kind of douchebag as they
I didn't
to
like
it.
The last episode either. I felt like it took a whole turn, and I just felt like it's a weird image that I just felt. I didn't know why they had to do the last episode. I thought they could have ended it the episode after, before.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I agree. They could have done it. But now it is what it is. You know, I mean, I'm happy. You know, I think you. I think the first five episodes is great, and it's also tell a very, very important thing about, you know, what happened in the noughties.
Yeah. Are you okay with Spotify recently announced they might be raising the price of subscription? Do you think that that's a necessary evil or?
No, it's not. I don't understand why people say it's evil. Netflix increased their prices. I mean, you know, almost every year, the last, you know, 10 years, you know, so why?
It's crazy just, that Spotify has it.
I don't understand, you know, it's everything now with the war we have in Europe, you know, and with the electricity and the inflation and the interest rates going up. I mean, I don't understand that. I don't know. Of course they should increase prices. It's super cheap to have all the music you want in the world just milliseconds away from you. And it's anywhere, anytime.
You probably double the price and it would still be worth it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course.
Per, I can't thank you enough for taking the time. This was so interesting and so fun, fascinating. And I can't wait. I don't know when I'm going to get out to see Abba Voyage, but when I see it, I will give you a full review and I will let you know how it is.
Please do.
Absolutely.
Take care.